Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the deteriorating situation between North and South Korea, with the North closing off access to its Kaesong Industrial Complex for South Korean workers and managers, and a declaration by North Korea's army that it has ratified a merciless attack against the United States involving a diversified nuclear strike. An expert on North Korea, Charles Armstrong, professor of history and director of the Center for Korean Research at Columbia University, joins us to discuss what is behind the dangerous threats by North Korea and the brinkmanship from Secretary of State John Kerry, who warned that the United States will not accept North Korea as a nuclear state. Then we'll examine how George W. Bush's signature No Child Left Behind legislation has backfired and led to the rash of cheating on test scores in 37 states, culminating with the arrest of 35 educators in Atlanta, including the former superintendent who was awarded Superintendent of the Year in 2009. Jonathan Zimmerman, a professor of education and history at New York University and author of Small Wonder, The Little Red Schoolhouse in History and Memory, and Who's America? Culture Wars in the Public Schools, joins us to discuss this scandal and the NRA's proposal to arm teachers. Then finally, we'll look into the future of Obama's Affordable Care Act, which could be undermined through a loophole that allows insurance giants to cherry-pick and extend policies through 2014, thus weakening the pool and driving up prices in the insurance exchanges scheduled to go into effect on January the 1st. The former head of corporate communications for Humana and Cigna, Wendell Potter, who has become a vocal critic of insurance company abuses, joins us to discuss how the Republicans will likely run against Obamacare in 2014 and the insurance giants could help them by sabotaging its implementation. Joining us now is Charles Armstrong, a professor of history and director of the Center for Korean Research at Columbia University. His books include The North Korean Revolution, 1945 to 1950, A History of the Peninsula, simply titled The Koreas, Korean Society, Civil Society, Democracy, and the State. And his latest book out soon is Tyranny of the Weak, North Korea and the World, 1950 to 1990. Welcome to Background Briefing, Charles Armstrong.
Good to be with you.
And the statement from the North Korean army that was carried on North Korea's official news agency says as follows: "We formally informed the White House and Pentagon that the ever-escalating U.S. hostile policy towards the DPRK and its reckless nuclear threat will be smashed by the strong will of all the United Service personnel and people and cutting-edge, smaller, lighter, and diversified nuclear strike means of the DPRK, and that the merciless operation of its Revolutionary Armed Forces in this regard has been finally examined and ratified." What do you make of that?
Well, in some ways, it's the same rhetoric they've been using for years now, basically saying that they will defend themselves by any means necessary and that they are not to be trifled with. What's new, however, is specifically saying that they will target the United States with a diversified nuclear strike. It's not quite clear what that means. I don't think we need to take that particular aspect of it all that seriously. I don't think there's any conceivable scenario in any near-time future that North Korea will actually send a nuclear missile to the United States, nor does it seem they have the capability technologically to do so. But it does reflect the ratcheting up of rhetoric to a degree that we have rarely, if ever, seen before.
Well, and of course, the closing off of the last link between the North and the South, the Kaesong Industrial Complex, I believe there's still some South Koreans inside, but that, I spoke recently with the former U.S. ambassador and CIA station chief, Donald Gregg, who felt that if that happens, that would be the kind of indication that, I think to quote him, that the lids were closing on the tanks and they're rolling out into the battle or something along those lines. So do you think that that is significant, this closing off of the last link?
Well, it's a pretty strong signal. I would hope that it doesn't mean that conflict is imminent. The Kaesong Industrial Project was very important for North Korea economically, and it was the last link to South Korea. And now that they've cut off the hotlines and other sorts of communication and economic ties to South Korea, my impression from what they've said and what they've done is this is intended to be temporary, to send a signal to the South that they mean business, and that once the situation, presumably at some point not too far in the future, calms down, that this will resume. But it is the last link that they've severed, and it is pretty worrisome that they've done this. I think the real danger that we face is not a direct conflict between the U.S. and North Korea, much less that North Korea will lob missiles at Washington or something like that, but that the North and South could come into a conflict through miscalculation or a reaction to provocation from the other side that could escalate into something very serious, and that would ultimately possibly involve the U.S.
Well, one of the things that Donald Gregg mentioned in the interview I did a couple of days ago was that when he was ambassador, he canceled these military exercises that go on every spring, and that in every time that these exercises have gone on, the North Koreans have suggested that this is a provocation or a feint for a real attack, and they've upped the rhetoric and upped their preparation for war. And these exercises have been going on since March, with the U.S. B-52s flying over on March the 19th, and then on the 27th, the North cut the military hotline with the South, and then on the 28th, the U.S. flew B-2 stealth bombers over the South, and then on the 30th, North said it was entering a state of war with the South. And then on the 2nd of April, the North said it's restarting the Yongbyon reactor, the one that they closed down that produces plutonium. And then today you have the announcement that I read about a diversified nuclear strike against the United States. I guess my question to you, Charles Armstrong, is why is the United States playing this game? If we don't want a war with this country, and there may be a blurry line between rhetoric and reality in North Korea, why not do what Don Gregg did when he was ambassador, cancel these exercises, not give them any excuse, no provocation?
That's a very good question. These exercises have been going on regularly since the 1970s, and each time they have happened, and indeed before they take place, usually North Korea says that this will be seen as a provocation. The exercises go forth. North Korea steps up its defenses in exchange, and we have a very tense situation. We've seen it this time, except the rhetoric is higher and the degree of military mobilization is higher than we've seen in a long time. So what each side presents as deterrence, the other sees as a provocation. And we are just playing into the hands of the hardliners and the saber rattlers in Pyongyang by sending B-52s, B-2s, nuclear submarines, or whatever. That's not going to resolve the situation. It's going to make it worse. So it would be, I think, very useful to take a bold step, which is to talk to North Korea, or at least to suspend the exercises, although it's probably not possible at this point, and see how they react.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Charles Armstrong, who's a professor of history and the director of the Center for Korean Research at Columbia University. His books include The North Korean Revolution, 1945 to 1950, A History of the Peninsula, simply titled The Koreas, Korean Society, Civil Society, Democracy, and the State. And his latest book, out soon, is Tyranny of the Weak, North Korea and the World, 1950 to 1990. And your title of your new book, Tyranny of the Weak, I think really does characterize the psychological situation. Because during the Cold War, when the United States and the Russians could have wiped each other out and destroyed most of the planet within 30 minutes of each other, there was almost a nuclear war in November of 1983 that was entirely based on perceptions. The Russians really believed that Ronald Reagan meant it when he said that the Soviets would end up on the ash heap of history, that Star Wars was real, that when he said the evil empire, he was really talking about what he thought of these people, and that underlined his motives. And of course, we see ourselves as being virtuous, we didn't plan on attacking the Soviet Union and destroying the world. But from their point of view, it looked like we were. So how much of this is going on now with the North Koreans? In other words, how divorced are they from our perceptions of our own virtues that we wouldn't start a war? At the same time, they seem to have both a paranoia that has been with them and has been used as a state tool in terms of the belief that the Americans are going to attack you at any moment. But at some point or other, it appears that there are a lot of people within North Korea and within the military actually believe this stuff.
Yes, the situation around North Korea looks very threatening to the North Koreans, particularly the position of the United States. We may see North Korea as a threat, but we are a much greater threat to North Korea as they understand it. They have a society that has been mobilized for war since 1950. They understand the Korean War as something that the U.S. started. However, we may understand history. That's the story they tell themselves, and that the U.S. has basically been out to destroy them, to wipe them out of existence for most of the time since. So they feel very threatened, very vulnerable, and that is the position from which they carry out these, what seem to be quite outrageous threats in this posturing. It's a position of weakness which they overcompensate for by these kinds of bellicose and what we see as provocative statements. We are in a much stronger position than they are, and it seems to me it would be more prudent for us to understand that than to continue to match them action for action, provocation for provocation, which could eventually, intended or not, lead to a much more serious military conflict.
Well, I don't understand why, for example, Charles Armstrong, the Secretary of State John Kerry, who had a joint briefing today in Washington with South Korea's Foreign Minister Yang Byung-se, and he said, John Kerry said, and I reiterate, the United States will do what is necessary to defend ourselves and defend our allies, Korea and Japan. We are fully prepared and capable of doing so, and I think the DPRK understands that. But his main point, which is the headline here, is that John Kerry said that the United States will not accept North Korea as a nuclear state. So given that that seems to be what they're bankrupting their country for, their GDP's gone down by 20%, I think, in the last few years because they're diverting all this money to the military and to building nuclear weapons. They're not going to give up these nuclear weapons, are they? That's their main centerpiece. That's their main, straw, if you will, in clinging to the notion that they have some power. If they are feeling that this is, in fact, the tyranny of the weak, why should we make this kind of statement? I just don't understand it.
It is puzzling. North Korea has made it very clear in recent months that it wants to be accepted as a nuclear weapon state and that they are not going to use their nuclear weapons as a bargaining chip and they're going to hold on to them. And we've responded by ratcheting up the threats and the rhetoric and the military positioning, and that makes them want to cling ever harder to what little they have, which is mainly their nuclear arsenal and their military. Now, we can say if we continue to push them, it will bankrupt the country and something will give. But they've been in pretty dire economic straits for quite some time now, and they're still around. So I wouldn't bank on that happening anytime soon. North Korea is determined to stay alive as a sovereign state. And if we ignore them, which the Obama administration has done for most of the last 5 years, the situation is only going to get worse. North Korea is going to continue to build more and more nuclear weapons, better long-range missiles, and 5 years down the road, or however long it is, it's going to be a much worse situation than we have now. So we've got to somehow break this logjam and find another way to resolve this crisis other than either ignoring North Korea, imposing sanctions, which have not worked, clearly, or threatening them with our military.
But just in closing, though, it makes no sense, does it? If we are so strong and they are so weak and they are acting out of paranoia, which is real and state-generated, but their history tells them and every experience going back to the Korean War is that the Americans are the aggressors, why are we doing this? I think, isn't it the obligation of the strong to turn the other cheek?
Well, that's a complicated question. I think there are many reasons that the U.S. is doing this. Part of it is because we've done this for so many years, we don't seem to know what else to do, although there have been a few moments, such as in the late Clinton administration, where it did seem that negotiation would lead to some positive outcomes, and again in the second Bush administration, but that has been largely reversed. And, you know, it has to be said that it's useful to be rather cynical for parts of our military-industrial complex to have a North Korean threat. We've just sped up the production of the development of missile defense. They've moved missile battery deployments to Guam. Mm-hmm. And we can't say that that's directed against China because our relationship with China is too important, although in reality that may be what it is.
Right.
But North Korea is a very convenient threat to have for these purposes.
Well, you know, it's just that they can make these ridiculous charges back and forth, but it could get out of hand and we'll all pay a terrible price. I thank you so much for joining us, Charles Armstrong.
You're welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with Charles Armstrong, a professor of history and director of the Center for Korean Research at Columbia University. His books include The North Korean Revolution, 1945 to 1950, A History of the Peninsula, simply titled The Koreas, Korean Society, Civil Society, Democracy, and the State. And his latest book out soon is Tyranny of the Weak, North Korea and the World, 1950 to 1990. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about how George W. Bush's No Child Left Behind has led to massive cheating.
No one likes us, I don't know why. We may not be perfect, but heaven knows we try. But all around, even our old friends put us down. Let's drop the big one and see what happens. We give them money, but are they grateful? No, they're spiteful and
welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jonathan Zimmerman, a professor of education and history and director of the History of Education program at the Steinhardt School of Culture, Education, and Human Development at New York University. He also holds an appointment in the Department of History at New York University's Graduate School of Arts and Sciences. A former Peace Corps volunteer and high school teacher, he's the author of Small Wonder, The Little Red Schoolhouse in History and Memory, Innocence Abroad, American Teachers in the American Century, and Who's America? Culture Wars in the Public Schools. He has an article at the Christian Science Monitor, Liberal Hypocrisy on Bloomberg's Moneyed Fight for Gun Control, and another article at Salon.com, What's Not Being Taught About the Iraq War. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jonathan Zimmerman.
It's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
And a couple of stories in the news involving education, perhaps in the worst possible sense and the worst possible light, a major cheating scandal that unfolded in Atlanta, where the superintendent of schools in Atlanta, or the former superintendent of schools in Atlanta, along with 34 others, 23 have already gone to jail. You know, the subtext of it seems to be this testing mania that came in with No Child Left Behind and the race to the top. And then there's the NRA story as well of them proposing putting armed guards in schools. Let's begin with the Atlanta story, since it seems to be ultimately laid at the footsteps of George W. Bush.
It is, but it's also laid at the footsteps of the United States Congress. And, you know, some of my colleagues who are critical of No Child Left Behind, as I am, they speak of it as if it was imposed in a Guatemalan military coup. I think every listener should understand that No Child Left Behind passed the United States Congress by a vote of 432, and that its sponsors included Edward Kennedy of Massachusetts and out in California, George Miller, who by some measurements is the most left-leaning member of the House of Representatives. Now, that doesn't make it good or wise or sound educational policy, but I do think it's a little facile to lay it at the feet only of George W. Bush, even though he did sign the legislation.
Well, but didn't he propose at all? That was he wanted to be the education president.
He did, yeah. But you know, the movement towards accountability, and especially accountability based on standardized testing, I think it's important to understand that it's been eminently bipartisan. It came out of the states, including a well-known governor in Arkansas, William Jefferson Clinton, who was a leader, really a pioneer in state-level accountability systems when he was the governor of Arkansas. And to telescope into the future, I think it's fair to say that the distance on educational policy between Barack Obama and his challenger last year, Mitt Romney, was infinitesimal. Only arguably on Afghanistan and Iraq could you find another policy in which they were as close to each other as they were. Now, again, I say that as a critic of these policies, but I do think, as in a spirit of self-criticism, we have to understand that historically and into the present, one of the reasons these policies have been so powerful, and I would argue so destructive, is because of their bipartisan roots.
Well, indeed, the catastrophe continued under Undersecretary of Education Arne Duncan. He hosted this Dr. Hall, a woman that's the former superintendent of schools, who was awarded in 2009 Superintendent of the Year Award. And she was appointed in 2010 by President Obama to the National Board of Education Sciences. So there's certainly plenty of blame to go around. But it's extraordinary, though, when you hear about these cheating parties that they had where they were doctoring the scores. And obviously, they were this No Child Left Behind has these rewards and punishments, incentives that have led to this kind of outrageous behavior. But the real victims are these children, surely, that these children whose tech scores were rigged, and they're ill-prepared for the world that they're entering because they've been caught up in this lie.
Well, yes, and I mean, I guess I'd say two things. I agree with you that it's appalling, but I'm sorry to say I don't find it surprising. We've actually heard this story before. We've never heard it on the scale and with the detail that we've heard it here because the Atlanta sting that caught these people was so complicated and longstanding. But, you know, in El Paso, Texas, and in Washington, D.C., there have been other cases of cheating. And it is appalling, but in some ways it's inevitable. And I think it's inevitable, frankly, because the real myth of No Child Left Behind is that simply by holding everybody to the same standard that we can achieve equality. Unlike some of my colleagues, I'm not opposed to the idea of creating common standards. I think some of the standards that have been created under No Child Left Behind are extremely invidious and specious. But the idea of creating, let's just say, thresholds and expectations that we want everybody to meet, not only do I not oppose that, but I think that's a no-brainer. The interesting question is, what should the assessments and the thresholds be? And most of all, what tools and what resources do we need to get there? The real problem with No Child Left Behind is not the creation of common standards. I would argue that we need those. The real problem is the absurd myth that simply by establishing those standards that we'll get everybody there. Because we know as a matter of history, as a matter of social science, as a matter of common sense, that kids come to these schools with radically different advantages and disadvantages, that the schools themselves are of radically different quality, and simply as if, like a little child, if we just wish it so, it will become so. That's the real problem with No Child Left Behind.
Well, it has led to a rash of cheating. It's not just Atlanta, but according to the independent monitoring group Fair Test, cheating is widespread, and it's fully documented in 37 states and Washington, D.C. So there's no question that this is, shall we say, the unintended consequence of the idea that you have these incentives and disincentives, and the schools who don't meet the test standards, score standards, lose money, and those that do get rewards. So isn't that the problem?
Absolutely. And also, to cut back to an earlier comment by you, it's really the least disadvantaged who get hurt the most. One of the other things we know empirically from looking at schools is that it's in the poorest communities where the instruction tends to be the most rote and the most test-driven. In Scarsdale or, you know, in Marin County, the schools can absorb the costs of NCLB, if you will, because the kids come with enough advantages already that they're going to do okay in the tests, and the school isn't going to suffer sanctions. But that's not the case in our poorer communities. So one of the things that scholars have found is that the poorer the community, the more likely you're going to see this extremely rigid lockstep instruction that's entirely geared towards getting the kids to score better on the test. And again, while I find that appalling and depressing, I don't find it surprising.
Now, let's turn to the other story involving education, and that was the release of a report by the NRA, at least by a group funded by the NRA, although the NRA and the group themselves tried to suggest that there was some distance between them. Asa Hutchinson, a former Republican congressman from Arkansas and the drug czar under President George W. Bush, announced the National School Shield Task Force findings in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday. And my understanding is that the vast majority of teachers and teachers' organizations in this country oppose the idea of having guns in school. So let's begin with that. That's pretty established. So I think about 70% of teachers think it's just a bad idea. And if they were allowed
definitely
to take guns to school, they wouldn't. That's what I understand.
And I've seen those numbers, and I've also seen numbers indicating that similar majorities of law enforcement officers want very strict gun control, which I think is a really relevant number as well. That is, the people who are closest to these threats and these tragedies don't think it's a really good idea for there to be more guns. They want fewer of them. I think that this issue is in many ways a red herring. I say this sharing all the grief and all the outrage about the Newtown shootings, but every listener has to understand that there has not been a rash of school shootings in this country. The real gun problem is not in our schools. Obviously, one gun death in the school is too many. But I fear that because of the way that the story has been reported and because of the way that the NRA, among others, has politicized it, that people get the misapprehension that gun shootings and especially mass gun shootings in our schools are on the rise. They are not. By every measure that I've seen, there are actually fewer of them than before. So again, I'm in no way trying to be callous or discount the tragedy of what happened, but I do think that one of the things we've learned over the years is that Americans tend to exaggerate the degree of every crime that exists. Most Americans don't know that violent crime of every kind has dropped, in some places plummeted, since the 1980s, and this is a good example of that.
Well, of course, it's a highly political issue. As you know, Jonathan Zimmerman, the president, today is in Colorado at the police academy, obviously tying into what you were saying about how police officers and police chiefs are also in favor of gun control. He's in a fight to push the Congress. Pushing it in the opposite direction, of course, is the NRA. And then you've got the threat of filibusters from Marco Rubio, Rand Paul, and Ted Cruz in the Senate. Rand Paul last week, where he spoke at the University of Kentucky, spoke about the Sandy Hook Elementary School massacre in Newtown, saying that it could have been prevented if school employees had carried firearms. Quoting him, the only thing that probably could have prevented that shooting would have been if the principal had a gun in his desk or if the teacher had a gun in his desk. So they,
and the principal was a she, but never
sure,
mind.
Well, I guess, you know, but there you have it. So that's the contours of this argument that's going on in the country. And it looks like the president is pulling out all the stops, but he's got an uphill battle.
He does have an uphill battle. And look, the reason it's an uphill battle is that the NRA and other gun rights organizations have done a splendid job of persuading Americans that they all have a right to own a gun. This is of incredibly recent vintage. I spoke about this on your show a few months ago. That is, the idea that the Second Amendment guarantees every individual a pretty much unbridled right to own a firearm. This is really the creation of our own time. That is, almost nobody believed that before the 1970s. And the NRA has done a superb job of persuading people of that. Indeed, I think the most important single piece of poll literature I've seen on this subject is that more Americans can identify the content of the Second Amendment than of the First Amendment. So that's what the president is dealing with. The very worst argument, in my view, for gun control, and I speak as a strong advocate of gun control, is that, quote, the people want it. Actually, the people are quite divided on the subject, and most poll literature shows that popular sentiment has trended away from gun control in recent years. And again, I say that as an advocate of it. But say, unlike the abortion issue, where pro-choice people like me are on pretty strong survey ground saying that Americans are mostly some species of pro-choice, gun rights thing, that doesn't work. You can go ahead and say, if you'd like, that, you know, Americans want stronger controls of guns, but actually, that's pretty much of a distortion. Americans are highly divided on it, and alas, in recent years, they've trended away from my point of view.
Well, but recent polling about what is being offered now, which is extremely modest, and after all, the Senate stripped out the assault weapons ban, apparently it's polling very, very high, up in the 80s.
It is. You know, background checks.
Background checks and not allowing mentally ill people to have firearms.
Definitely. And look, these are all important measures. Obviously, I support them, and I'm delighted to see that more Americans are supporting them. But I also think it's fair to say, in a certain sense, they're chipping around the edges. That's not to say I'm against them. Of course, I want those. They're no-brainers to me. But after all is said and done, even if the president wins that battle, millions of Americans are still going to believe it's entirely legitimate. Indeed, it's constitutionally based that anybody who, you know, has passed a background check or doesn't have a mental illness can just drive to a gun shop and get a firearm. That's the real problem. That's where the NRA has, up until now, won the day. And that's really what has to be taken on.
So, Jonathan, one of the problems with the NRA is not just that they're extremely clever at the way they propose legislation, is that they're in a sort of fact-free universe, as are some of the supporters like Rand Paul and Ted Cruz. They say outrageous things that aren't sourced in reality. And in this report, by the way, that they just came out with on Tuesday, the National School Shield Task Force, even though it's a front group, they're saying they cite a case in 2010 in Hastings Middle School in Minnesota where a 16-year-old attacker, according to the NRA, killed six people hiding in a locked classroom in Hastings Middle School in Minnesota, and by shooting and subsequently stepping through a tempered glass window that ran vertically alongside the classroom door. What really happened there, and this is from the actual Hastings, Minnesota police report, that this student was brandishing a loaded handgun at teachers and students in at least two Hastings Middle School classrooms when this happened on Monday back in 2010. An eighth grade student spread terror but fired no shots before being tackled and subdued by a school police officer. So there you, I mean, we can't even, in this debate, we're not even dealing with the facts, and they're citing incidents that simply didn't happen.
Yeah, and I think that's true. I've read about that case. And also, I think there's a lot of distortion about Columbine, because apparently there was at least one armed guard at Columbine. So, look, there's absolute distortion there. But I could tell you, as a scholar, I also feel that there's often distortion on the other side of this issue. I think that some gun control groups have exaggerated what we know about the beneficial effects of gun control. And again, I say that as a strong advocate for the strongest imaginable form of gun control. But I do think that in this country, when an issue like this is politicized, that there's distortion on every side. And gun control measures have been so weak in this country that I should tell you that in an evidentiary sense, it's often a very difficult thing for social scientists to show their benefits. And I think, unfortunately, that does lead certain parties in my own camp to exaggerate what we know about them. It's not an argument against them. It's just a statement that there's been distortion.
But your piece, Jonathan Zimmerman, in the Christian Science Monitor, Liberal Hypocrisy on Bloomberg's Moneyed Fight for Gun Control, makes the case that it is hypocritical for progressives who are in favor of campaign finance reform to support Mayor Bloomberg. But on the other hand, given that the NRA put in $25 million in the 2012 elections, how do you basically have some kind of level playing field in this corrupt system? Do you take the high road like Russ Feingold did, Senator Feingold, in the last election, where he refused to take PAC money and refused to have negative advertising, and a Tea Party guy beat him because he unilaterally disarmed? So, on the one hand, your point's taken that it's hypocritical. On the other hand, what do you do about it when you're facing an avalanche of money on the other side?
Well, look, a unilateral disarm, by the way, is a clever metaphor in this whole discussion. I do think it's a tough call, but there would be nothing inconsistent about gun rights groups saying, we're grateful for Mike Bloomberg's intercession here and for his money, but we also don't think that in our politics, the size of your wallet should determine how much influence you have in the process. I don't think there's anything inconsistent about saying that. And, my mailbox has just filled up with people saying, are you saying that we should, disarm, fight with one hand behind our back? I'm not. And incidentally, I think that if you call yourself a liberal, okay, what it means to me is that you should scrutinize your own assumptions as much as possible and try to bring your behavior into accord with your ideals. It's perfectly consistent to say in the same breath that rich people like Mike Bloomberg could not be allowed to have the megaphone that they have, but that, we like gun control. And any time that we can help put forth two ideas at the same time, we should do so. There's no reason to silence ourselves in this instance in the favor of gun control. You can say both things.
Well, of course, though, the idea that rich people spending money is unfair, because that's been sanctioned by the Supreme Court. And
exactly. And people like me raised a big fuss about that.
Right. But it seems to me that the other side of Bloomberg, the argument about Bloomberg, are the Koch brothers. So as long as you've got, as we have here in the United States, a somewhat oligarchical system, maybe that's what we should be focusing on. Are we a democracy or have we become an oligarchy?
Well, that's the question, and I'm not willing yet to throw in the towel.
Well, Jonathan, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you. It was really fun.
Again, I've been speaking with Jonathan Zimmerman, who is a professor of education and history and director of the History of Education program at the Steinhardt School of Culture, Education, and Human Development at New York University. He also holds an appointment in the Department of History at NYU's Graduate School of Arts and Sciences. A former Peace Corps volunteer and high school teacher, he's the author of Small Wonder, The Little Red Schoolhouse in History and Memory, Innocence Abroad, American Teachers in the American Century, and Who's America? Culture Wars in the Public Schools. He has an article at the Christian Science Monitor, Liberal Hypocrisy on Bloomberg's Moneyed Fight for Gun Control, and another article at Salon.com, What's Not Being Taught About the Iraq War. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking with a former insurance company insider about how the insurance giants are finding ways to get around Obamacare.
It's just a goodbye. Teach your children well. Their father's hell did slowly go by. And feed them on your dreams. The one they picked, the one you know by.
And so no one would know how tired they've grown of talking and telling their lies. All we've got, no health insurance, no cellular service, no disease they can cure. But we need
more money to burn, so each person must learn the dollar amount they are worth.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Wendell Potter, an author, media analyst, and corporate watchdog. After a 20-year career in the for-profit health industry as the chief corporate spokesperson at Cigna Corporation and as head of corporate communications at Humana Inc., he became a vocal critic of insurance company abuses. He is now a senior analyst at the Center for Public Integrity and a senior fellow on healthcare at the Center for Media and Democracy. His latest book is Deadly Spin, an insurance company insider speaks out on how corporate PR is killing healthcare and deceiving Americans. Welcome to Background Briefing, Wendell Potter.
Thank you, Ian.
And Wendell, the LA Times carried a story on April the 2nd. The health insurance giants discover ways to skirt Obamacare regulations for an entire year. And from what I understand from this LA Times story, that there's a little-known loophole in President Obama's signature Affordable Care Act that allows insurance companies to extend existing policies all the way through 2014. And, of course, on January the 1st, 2014, is when the health exchange begins, and this will have the effect of diluting the effectiveness of the health exchange. Is that right?
That's right. It would be possible for some companies to do this if they chose to do it, but it would mean that they would try to circumvent the new regulations by changing the renewal dates of some of their customers' policies so that they would be going through the end of 2014. So this would certainly be a way in which they could try to circumvent the intent of the law.
But the idea is that if everybody's in the pool, the prices will go down, right? And that's the idea of the exchange. So if some of these big companies with basically continue their existing policies and therefore don't join the exchange, and United Health Group and WellPoint, which runs Blue Cross here in California, have indicated that they probably will. Kaiser Permanente have said that they won't, that they'll start on January the 1st. So if the other giants and used to work for these companies join, how will it affect the exchange?
Well, it could certainly reduce the size of the exchanges, which would not be a good thing. You need as many people as you can possibly get in the exchanges to spread the risk so that you have a price that is more fair to those who are in the pool. If you try to game the system, as the LA Times story suggested some insurers are thinking of doing, then it would indeed reduce the number of people who would be in exchange beginning in 2014. You can't keep doing that forever, but it could mean that in 2014, fewer people than expected would be in the exchange.
But this will have a political effect, won't it? I mean, already it's always been mystifying to me that the Affordable Care Act was structured in such a way that the benefits to consumers and therefore to voters wasn't particularly apparent, and some of the greater benefits come in late, like this exchange coming in next year. So this has had a political effect. This has allowed the Republicans who want to destroy Obamacare and repeal it. Isn't this a part of a strategy, surely, that if the public don't even know what the benefits are, and then if the White House didn't sell them very well, and then when the big part of the Affordable Care Act comes into play on January the 1st and people's premiums go up, then that's going to have the effect of turning people away from the Affordable Care Act. Isn't that likely?
Well, it certainly could be, and it would certainly play into the hand, the strategy, as you noted, of the opponents of the law. And really, the main opponents of the law are the opponents of the president, who, you know, they would like to see nothing more than they worked against his reelection, and they also would like to see a change in Congress. They'd like to see the Senate change hands from Democratic to Republican control. And this is where the insurance industry can play and has played for many years a significant role, because I know from having served as head of the Political Action Committee, or at least the person who was responsible for the disbursement of funds, that insurance companies contribute to their allies in politics, so those who think they can convert the allies to vote the way they want to. This would indeed fall into that category.
So again, I'm speaking with Wendell Potter, who is an author, media analyst, and corporate watchdog. After a 20-year career in the for-profit health industry as chief corporate spokesperson at Cigna Corporation, as head of corporate communications at Humana, Inc., he became a vocal critic of insurance company abuses, and he is the author of Deadly Spin, an insurance company insider speaks out on how corporate PR is killing healthcare and deceiving Americans. Now, so this could be a strategy in conjunction with Republicans, who the large insurance giants clearly favor, or it could be that they're just operating out of self-interest. What is the self-interest here if it's not mendacious, if they're not out to destroy the Affordable Care Act? Why extend these policies for an extra year?
It's all about the money. If you can extend the policies to go through a period in which all of the provisions of the Affordable Care Act don't apply, then you're saving money. Keep in mind that a lot of the reason for the Affordable Care Act was to do away with some of the most egregious practices of the insurance industry. And a lot of those practices will become illegal on January the 1st. People buying policies through the exchange will be able also to get subsidies to help them buy coverage. So they want to try to avoid the consumer protections as much as possible. And it is self-interest more than anything else. But keep in mind, to perpetuate their self-interest, they want to make sure that they're working closely with their political allies. And that's, I'm certain that that is indeed going on. And I think it's going to be important for state lawmakers to address this as well. The Los Angeles Times said that in California, some state lawmakers are indeed working on a bill that would address this renewal issue. And I think that hopefully that will not only be introduced, but will be passed this year.
But what apparently these health insurance giants can do is they can cherry pick the healthy people on their rolls. I mean, the whole idea of the Affordable Care Act is that everybody's pooled in, and those that are being denied coverage for pre-existing conditions and other reasons that the insurance companies somewhat arbitrarily state. Wouldn't this be a long way towards that goal on the part of the insurance companies, that they'd keep their healthy people and consign the risky and unhealthy people to the Affordable Care Act, at least for a year?
Yeah, I think that's undoubtedly one of the objectives here, is to try to do that, just that. And we're talking about a book of business for these insurance companies that at which their money is at stake. I don't want to get too far into the weeds to differentiate between their kinds of health plans, but this would be certainly a way for them to continue to cherry pick. Cherry picking is one of those practices that will become unlawful. Or at least it was the intent of Congress for it to become unlawful on January the 1st, at which insurance companies could no longer discriminate against people because of their age or their health status or their gender. For many, many years, insurance companies have done that, and it's one of the reasons why we have an inordinate number of women who are uninsured. They have to pay, they've been charging women considerably more than men for many, many years. And people who are older often are charged up to 10 times as much as young people for the exact same coverage. That kind of stuff is supposed to end on January the 1st.
So, Wendell Potter, then, what explains how this loophole got in the legislation in the first place? I mean, did they get snookered? Were they not paying attention? Was this one of these little mendacious things that the NRA is so good at, of sneaking these little loopholes in that end up being so big you could drive a battleship through them?
Yeah, I think that it probably was something that just wasn't on anybody's radar screen when the law was being drafted. And I'm sure it's something that some people at these insurance companies have become aware of, that this is a way that they can take advantage of probably undoubtedly an unintended loophole. I think that had Congress anticipated this, they would have written language that would specifically prohibited this. But that's exactly what they would have had to have done, would be to have languages that is expressly prohibiting this. And since it apparently doesn't, this loophole apparently does exist, and we'll just have to see if these companies really do. I think that the administration should also do whatever it can to discourage this, and I think that they can do that. They probably can't keep it from happening, but they certainly could. They probably could do some things through rulemaking and regulations to discourage it.
Well, I'm just trying to put myself, project forward, if you will, Wendell Potter, to the political debate that would be taking place in September, October of 2014, ahead of the November elections for the midterm, at which point the Republicans could increase their numbers in the Senate, even take over the Senate and maintain the House, and therefore make Obama a lame duck. And there's no question that this will affect his presidency, and it would affect the fate of the Democrats in terms of their control of the Senate. I don't think anybody has any illusions that they're going to win back the House, but they may. Who knows? But the point is that if you've got a surly and angry electorate who feel that Obama's signature Affordable Care Act hasn't worked for them because the insurance companies are basically holding on to all their policyholders and weakening and undermining the insurance exchange, which will mean that this Affordable Care Act is not going to bring the premiums down, I can foresee that being a major Republican campaign issue.
Oh, it absolutely will. And I think this plays into that strategy. As we were talking earlier, the ultimate objective here is to have some bearing on the midterm elections in 2014. Even without this loophole, it's going to be an enormous undertaking to make sure all the exchanges are up and running on October the 1st, which is the date that the switch has to be flipped and the exchanges all over the country have to be operational. That's in the law. It has to happen. There's no doubt that some states will be doing a better job than others. And the federal government, quite frankly, has to operate more than half of them because a lot of the states are just acquiescing to the federal government to operate them. And then on January the 1st, when these plans are the effective dates of these plans are to go into effect, that will present yet another opportunity for chaos. There's already a lot of confusion, and as you've noted, a lot of people don't know how the law will affect them. A majority of Americans, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation poll recently, don't have a clue how the Affordable Care Act will affect them or how it will benefit them. So there has to be a considerable amount of education to be done between now and October the 1st, and a lot of effort needs to go into anticipating what can go wrong and trying to counter the misinformation that will also be very, very prevalent around that time.
Well, already, Wendell Potter, it's been clear that the southern states, for example, have opted out. There have been a few surprises. Florida, of course, in spite of Rick Scott being incredibly hostile, and he's a former convicted felon for widespread fraud of Medicare when he ran a health provider, I guess it was. He seems to have had his come-to-Jesus moment, and some other governors that have expressed hostility towards Obamacare have changed their mind. But as you say, they've just allowed the federal government to take it over. Give me a sense of where you see the landscape now in terms of those, like the Texas governor, that are in effect imposing their own ideology on the people in their states. They can get away with it if Obamacare is not popular, if people don't feel that they're being deprived something that they really need. But on the other hand, if you could make the case that these Obama haters are really hurting the American people, then you'd have a strong movement to support Obamacare. So where do we stand in that, in those terms of those dynamics?
Well, I think, and I just was in Texas not long ago, and I think the governor there probably thinks that he has the support of of the population. It's more of a conservative state than many others, to oppose the expansion of the Medicaid program, for example, which is sad because Texas has the distinction of being the state with the highest percentage of its residents being uninsured. More than one out of every four people in Texas is uninsured. But it would be a tragedy for those people if the Medicaid program is not expanded. I frankly think that it ultimately will. I think that what you're seeing here is some grandstanding that will enable these politicians to use the Affordable Care Act to their political advantage in 2014. I think the law will go forward. And I think that even the states that are saying they will not expand the Medicaid program ultimately will, because it will benefit the hospitals in those states, for example. And I think that the governors and politicians will be coming under increasing pressure from hospital executives and others who will say, this makes no sense for you to keep banning the expansion of the Medicaid program in your state.
Well, just in closing, Wendell Potter, what do you see in terms of a PR campaign then in advance of the big changes that will take place in October? And then, of course, the main part of the Affordable Care Act goes into play on January the 1st. So up until October, when you talked about the education process that's needed, obviously the president at the moment is distracted over the gun issue. But, you know, he hasn't done a good job, or the White House hasn't done a good job of selling Obamacare from day one. They've allowed the other side to frame it as this terrible thing that's going to take away our liberties and destroy our lives, when in fact, it's, as far as I can tell, it's been the greatest step forward in improving health care. It's not what a lot of people wanted, which is single payer that works everywhere else in the world, but at least it's a vast improvement. That is not the accepted reality. The evidence isn't there, is it?
The evidence is not there. And I think we're not going to be able to rely on the White House. They've shown that they're just not capable or willing to devote the resources to the kind of educational campaign that we need to inform people. I think it will have to come from healthcare reform advocates, and there are still many who obviously are very supportive of the appropriate implementation of the Affordable Care Act. I, for one, am going to be going around the country and will be in California to talk about what to anticipate and to help advocates be prepared for this onslaught of misinformation and to help them deal with just the chaos that will surround the implementation on October the 1st and January the 1st.
Well, Wendell Potter, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, Ian. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Wendell Potter, who's an author, media analyst, corporate watchdog, after a 20-year career in the for-profit health industry as a chief corporate spokesperson at Cigna Corporation and as head of corporate communication at Humana, Inc. He became a vocal critic of insurance company abuses. He's now a senior analyst at the Center for Public Integrity and a senior fellow on healthcare at the Center for Media and Democracy. His latest book is Deadly Spin, an insurance company insider speaks out on how corporate PR is killing healthcare and deceiving Americans. And this has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Nick Guarino. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.